Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And a little later in the show, we'll be continuing our conversation as it concerns healthcare. Now, we talked about it a couple times, but continuing as the controversy continues and also talking about the potential prospects for single payer. And we'll also touch on this show on a little bit about the CIA, its own history, and whether or not there may or may not be a deep state, and also some of the recent pieces from Seymour Hersh and what that means for Trump, Putin, Russia, the whole thing. But before we can move on, well, the healthcare debate keeps rolling on despite the fact Republicans won't be voting before they abscond from Washington tomorrow to head back to their districts for the July 4th holiday. However, deals are being thrown around fast and furious under the Capitol Dome as Republicans try to get some sort of healthcare bill together to meet the promise they made for seven straight years to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act with another law that would provide better healthcare more cheaply to the nation. The problem is, basically all of their proposals do the exact opposite and provide less healthcare more expensively. As we've reported to you yesterday, only 35% of Republicans, 35%, low number, think this is a good bill. So the real song and dance here is how to scale back the mass destruction of people's health and well-being proposed currently to a level where the broader Republican caucus will find it acceptable. But that's tricky because you've got the hard right senators who want to move forward with totally destroying anything resembling health care that's affordable and comprehensive for anyone who isn't rich. Then you have the so-called moderates, many from purple states, who see how unpopular the whole thing is and figure it's better to either stick with the ACA with some small fixes or just do nothing because they don't want to put this in and then have the people who lost their health care turn them out in the election next year. And in and of itself, that's pretty interesting because it reveals that a large section of the Republican Party was posturing against so-called Obamacare for no other reason than to just try to hurt Obama. It was a demand that was totally unconnected to reality. It appears Republicans didn't have so much as a working group to prepare for this day. It also reveals that they almost certainly never thought Donald Trump would be president and were happy to keep doubling down on the whole repeal and replace thing all last year, feeling like they had nothing to worry about, I'm sure, since Hillary would probably veto whatever bill they came up with. So now, when it's on the rocks, into the breach, steps Ted Cruz. Cruz, who's hated even by many Republicans for being a lone wolf and not being afraid to tank legislation that he doesn't like so that he can posture. In other words, the last person you'd ever consider to be a deal maker. Well, he's been shopping around the rough outlines of a deal to other Republicans that many think could break the deadlock. The basic idea here is this. As long as insurers offer at least one ACA-compliant plan in the state, it would then be free to offer non-compliant plans as well. And then they would leave some of the ACA taxes in place in order to pay for the people left in ACA plans, the subsidies for those people, and to put more money back into Medicaid and lessen the effects of those cuts. So sounds like a pretty decent compromise, right? At least from the point of view of Republicans. Well, here's the issue, though. Sick people would choose ACA plans. Healthy people would gravitate towards the cheap plans, which means that the ACA plans will become more and more expensive because only the people who needed a lot of care would have them, and to cover the cost, it would require higher premiums. Now, you might say, well, a lot of those people get those subsidies though, right? Well, yes. But for them to really remain meaningful, the government would have to subsidize at a higher and higher rate over time because, as I was just saying, the cost of healthcare will keep going up and up and up if the only people who are in these ACA plans are the people who need the most healthcare coverage. So that means the government would then be on the hook for providing what could be hundreds of billions of dollars in tax revenue to what basically would be a government-funded high-risk pool. Now, Cruz says that's okay with him. He can accept that. And that, in fact, it's better to pay directly out of tax revenue than, quote unquote, force other people to subsidize lower premiums by making everyone sign up for an ACA compliant plan. And that's the basic rub with those plans is the people who basically never go to the doctor, the money they pay is subsidies for the people who are there all the time. So are the other Republicans going to accept that? Well, I don't know. Who knows? And will the increased funds for the Medicaid be enough anyway to calm the fears of Republican governors pressuring their delegations to oppose this bill? who really knows? And Mitch McConnell is also trying to sweeten the deal by throwing some extra cash in there. So again, it's all still up in the air. However, the Cruz proposal could get the conversation started again. Notably, too, it's a pretty big admission from Cruz that the government should fund what would ostensibly be these high-risk pools, because this is a person who says the government has no role to play, now acknowledging that the government can and should play a role in healthcare, and that a pure market approach is flawed, something that, quite frankly, was already clear, but that Republicans were refusing to acknowledge. So what happens with Cruz's proposal, we'll have to see, and it really basically would still be a terrible bill. But the upshot of the whole thing is the rumors of the Senate healthcare bill's death may be greatly exaggerated. Brian Encina, former Texas state trooper who pulled over Sandra Bland and arrested her, which set in train events that led to her death, will not face perjury charges, which had him under a cloud. Encina was charged by a grand jury in 2016 with lying on the police report dealing with the traffic stop. But now, for whatever reason, prosecutors decided they weren't going to follow through with the prosecution and have announced that they will drop the charges. Now, this comes in the wake of the Sandra Bland law being passed, and it's a Texas law, being passed in a much watered-down form by the state of Texas. It ignored most of the provisions that were designed to either prevent traffic stops and arrests like those that led to Bland's death, or at least drastically reduce them. So Sandra Bland's death, it sparked a nationwide conversation about policing, about jails, about race, and about mental health. It resulted in at least one bill being passed in the Texas State Senate. However, sadly, it doesn't seem like it's led or will lead to anyone being held accountable for at all for her being found dead in her jail cell. The Bureau of Justice Statistics, that's a federal agency, it's under the Justice Department, has just released new reporting on hate crimes in the United States. The most notable thing about the report is that it highlighted that most hate crimes actually still go unreported, about half of them in some ways. In the report, the Bureau noted, quote, that a lower percentage, 54%, of hate crimes went unreported to the police during the 2011 to 2015 period as compared to the 2007 to 2011 period, where 64% went unreported. The most common reason for not reporting violent hate crimes to police, that the victimization was handled, quote unquote, another way. 44% of the time that was the case. And that's not really well explained, but it says it's privately or through a non-law enforcement official. So I guess people just found some way to deal with it that didn't result in them needing to call the cops in their mind. Now, 20% of people said that they didn't report because it wasn't important enough to them to report, which may have something to do with how the police seem to not care at all about hate crimes in the United States, just about, you know, whatever, a Muslim terrorist or something. Now, one other finding in the report is what experiences many of the people who are experiencing these hate crimes had. 99% of the victims reported that the offender used hate language during the incident. 5% of the offenders left hate symbols, and 46% of violent hate crime victims said that the offender was a stranger. This report comes at the same time there's a lot of reporting coming from the nonprofit and advocacy world as well that's detailing an uptick in hate crimes in the U.S. and also at the same time as the report that we mentioned to you earlier this week about how most terrorist incidents are actually committed by white supremacists. But to give you another example of the rise of hate crimes here, the Council on American Islamic Relations, for instance, has reported a 57% increase in incidents of anti-Muslim bias between 2015 and 2016, when there were over 2,000 of these incidents, over 2,200, I think, actually. The United States there, land of the free, home of the brave, where the most terrorist attacks are committed by white racists and crimes motivated by hatred and bias have been on the rise since before Trump was even elected. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we continue our conversation by Jeff Morley, who is the Washington correspondent for Alternet and author of an upcoming book on the CIA. Mr. Morley, thank you so much for joining the show again.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start here with, well, I guess this is an overarching issue here on so many different levels, but the relationship between Trump and Putin, United States and Russia, seems like it really has been trending downward, or at least away from where it did appear to be going during the presidential campaign. Monday, the White House making kind of a bizarre announcement, this sort of a cryptic announcement about Syria potentially paying a heavy price for different things. And it just seems like the two countries more and more on a different page. And I don't know, it just seems the whole thing about Trump and Putin being so close together is collapsing a bit here.
I wouldn't say it's collapsing. It's changing. Trump and Putin had a profound bromance during the campaign where they couldn't praise each other enough. Now that Trump is in power, you know, other forces are bearing down on it, and he's finding it very hard to deliver on promises for his friend. And Putin didn't go into this relationship looking for a chum. He went into it looking for advantages. And if Trump doesn't supply him with advantages, he will not be his friend anymore. So the bromance is now cooling. And I think an interesting question for both of them is, how do they manage this? Because what's happening is the country's national interests are becoming more important than their friendship. And these leaders have to deal with that.
Well, is it their national interest, I guess, on the one hand? Because, I mean, I think that's the question that a lot of people were asking about Trump from the beginning, right? Was, is the, I mean, you know, whatever people may or may not say, should the U.S. and Russia have more cooperation? Certainly, President Obama seemed to think, at least maybe not to some Trump's degree, but that, yes, there should be some greater degree of cooperation. It faded a little bit there towards the end. But sort of a consistent theme with Russia post-Cold War, what the relationship should be, I think some people might argue that the other forces, sort of the more neoconservative, you know, Russia's our enemy forces, as opposed to the national interest or what them getting more power is what's really happening here.
Well, these decisions were Trump's. They weren't made by neoconservatives. Neoconservatives didn't decide to launch an aggressive policy in Syria. Trump and his advisors are pursuing that policy. So the language that Trump used during the campaign, which was anti-war, let's stay out of the conflicts in Syria. Maybe the U.S. and Russia can work together with ISIS. You know, he seemed to be looking to recast that relationship in a way where Russia and the United States were not on opposite sides. But now, with these latest threats, he's clearly pursuing a policy that is directly challenging Putin's policy in Syria. So, you know, that's a problem for both of them. I mean, I think for Trump, he hasn't really thought this thing out about, you know, he wants to be aggressive and show that he's aggressive and launch missiles and issue warnings and stuff like that. But he's doing it in a very complex situation where Putin is already very strong. I mean, Putin has an ally in Syria. His intervention in the war helped Assad stay in power. Putin's not going to throw that away because he likes Trump, you know, and Trump doesn't seem to be aware of what Putin's interests are in Syria. He doesn't understand Syria any more than he understands the healthcare bill. So that creates a problem for Putin. You know, his American friend, who he worked so hard to elect, can't really deliver for him. So I think the future for the Trump-Putin relationship, like you said, it's a lot darker now than it was during the campaign.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly the case here in the way it's moving. And, you know, to some degree, that was the piece that was underlying a little bit of Seymour Hersh's article on Trump ignoring evidence around whether or not Syria was behind this chemical strike before he launched this missile, was the lack of understanding of Trump on so many different levels. But not just him, even many of the people around him being sort of maybe amateurs is the way to put it, or whatever it was. I mean, I was shocked in that article, if it's true, that Rex Tillerson, for instance, had no idea what suppressing fire was. I mean, I thought that was just common knowledge. So, I mean, to some degree, part of what it seems to me could be happening here is that Trump maybe didn't have a good full idea of how he wanted to govern and has assembled a team of people that aren't much more skilled at sort of developing a strategic plan here.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Trump comes to office without a strong vision. He comes with some strong sentiments, but you know, the idea of policy as opposed to just kind of general positions, his mind doesn't really work that way. And so he is ill-equipped to govern. And And as he assembles a team around him, people who are more equipped to govern are, you know, are getting their way more. So the Trump, stay out of the Middle East impulse of the campaign is completely gone. And now Trump is really pursuing the policy in Syria that Hillary Clinton advocated in her debates with President Obama. President Obama wanted to stay out, to limit U.S. involvement. He didn't think there was any way the U.S. could influence the situation for the better. Hillary Clinton always wanted a more aggressive policy, controlling Syrian airspace, funding anti-Assad rebels. And now that's exactly what Trump is doing. He's doing the Hillary Clinton agenda in Syria.
I think that's a good point. And I mean, maybe that's what I really meant vis-a-vis the neoconservatives. I mean, sort of the role of the foreign policy consensus, the fact that Trump has landed up in the same place where Hillary Clinton, who had all the support from so many of these people who are sort of deep in the national security foreign policy establishment, many of whom were highly critical of President Obama, who often seemed to be kind of alone there in terms of arguing for restraint in situations like, say, Ukraine, and that the fact that Trump has ended up in the exact same place despite campaigning against it is maybe more of as much a commentary about Trump as it is about sort of the permanent foreign policy interests that exists within all these institutions.
It's a very vivid demonstration that it takes a lot of effort by a president to resist the natural inclination of the foreign policy establishment and the military establishment to intervene. And President Obama dedicated a lot of effort to resisting intervention in Syria. And, I think President Trump isn't capable of that. I don't think he's capable of sustained effort to say no to somebody in service of a geopolitical goal. So he's kind of gotten rolled, and he's now finds himself, you know, expanding a war in Syria that it seems like he doesn't know what he's getting into. It's a dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a good point. And in some ways, also sort of an interesting side commentary on not only one thing he campaigned on, but that a lot of Republicans do. Some Democrats do. I'm a businessman. I know how to make deals. I know how to do this. But the worlds of sort of private business, even on a geopolitical scale, are so different than sort of driving the interest of any nation, certainly the most powerful on earth. And it just seems like that's also being reflected now, too, is that sort of competency in sort of one field doesn't speak to competency in another.
No, Trump has really shown very little ability to get a legislative deal done. And we don't know what's going to happen with the health care bill, but whatever happens, it will be Mitch McConnell's doing. And Trump is really a spectator and not one that the Republicans particularly respect or care for. They're trying to keep him away from this deal because Trump can do nothing to salvage it and much to sabotage it. So, yeah, as a deal maker, it's been shown, or we are learning, that he's not really very competent in the area of making legislative deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's pretty remarkable to read the Washington Post article laying out, you know, sort of the inside out of that meeting where he said it would be okay to not pass the bill, right? When all the Republicans are like, no, we're going to pass this thing just a little later. It just showed it. I don't even know what it showed, but to me, it was just obviously a sign that the president is not 100% there.
A lack of enthusiasm. You know, he doesn't really care, precisely because it is difficult. It requires sustained, tedious effort. It requires compromise. It requires taking other people's opinions into account. And Trump's just not very good at any of those things. So yeah, he wants to get on to the next thing that excites him and pleases him and interests him. And it's certainly not healthcare.
Well, we are going to take a break on that note. And we are going to move on to other things after this on By Any Means Necessary here in Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary, Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation here with Jeff Morley, who's the Washington correspondent for Alternet and the author of an upcoming book on the CIA, touching on a lot of different things. And I wanted to turn the page here just a touch, Mr. Morley, because I alluded to this article earlier, the Seymour Hersh article in Die Welt that a lot of people are talking about. Essentially, for those who don't know, the article is alleging that the U.S. intelligence community pretty clearly stated that the alleged sarin gas attack in Syria and Khan Yunis, it was not that, and that President Trump went ahead and launched this missile strike, essentially heedless, irregardless of what was actually coming to him from his own government. So I wanted to touch on a couple pieces here, but the first thing I'm really curious your thoughts about are sort of the way this thing has played out with Seymour Hersh in the first place. I mean, you know, really going back to the Ratline article in the first Syria, it really even maybe back to the Osama bin Laden thing, the London Review of Books articles, it seems like Hersh, people have been taking him less seriously. And for years and years, of course, the knock on Hersh was, well, he's got all these anonymous sources. And so who really knows what's going on? People, you would defend him. Obviously, he has revealed a lot of things, so generally trustworthy guy, I would say. But overall, now it seems, it just seems like an interesting paradox to me. At the time where now where everyone is using an anonymous source for every story, it seems like in the mainstream media these days, Seymour Hersh is kind of on the outside looking in and people still doubting his work. I don't know. It just seems like a weird paradox to have his article be so sort of – it's in a German publication that almost no Americans know about. It's not being reported on in the mainstream media and people are basically treating it as if it's not like a credible story because it's an anonymous source when, you know, look at the Post, look at the New York Times. I don't know. It just seems interesting to me. Your thoughts?
Well, I think we got to separate two things. One, this particular article with Seymour Hersh and Seymour Hersh's work in general. You mentioned several articles. So I just want to talk about this article in particular. I mean, it's really based on a single anonymous source. And so I think it's a weak article. I mean, if what he's saying is true, he should have been able to find somebody to corroborate it. Without corroboration, I wonder. It's interesting. I do trust Hersh. I believe that, you know, he has a source who said these things. But why can't he corroborate it? Why isn't there somebody else who has an opinion of what was going on about the intelligence reporting around the chemical attack that says the same thing? So, you know, I think as an editor, I would say this is not among Hersh's strongest pieces. And I think people are right to, you know, take it with a grain of salt or to be cautious about embracing it. It's just not that strong a story. Now, that said, the larger question about Seymour Hersh, do his political views mean that he can't get published, you know, as readily as others? Yeah, he's an independent voice. And, you know, he's not gonna follow an institutional line like reporters at the Washington Post or the New York Times have to do. I don't think that those reporters are using anonymous sources now more than they ever did. That the practice of using anonymous sources has been around for a long time. So, you know, I think Hersh will command attention when he comes forward with a stronger story.
Maybe. I don't know, though, because I thought the stories in the London Review of Books on the Osama bin Laden thing were strong, and that never made much of a difference. But let me just put it to you like this, I guess. I hear you. Anonymous sources have been around for a long time. But, you know, you look at that Washington Post article on Dan Coats. I mean, that was a third person. They reported a game of telephone anonymously. The person who they had, who they said was a high-level source, was reporting something they heard from someone who heard it from someone else, who then heard it from Dan Coats, and only him, in a meeting with the president and two other people, and they printed it like this is a real story and the whole world ran with it. Now, maybe it's true and it happened exactly that way, but I don't see how a story like that is any weaker than Hersh's source when it's also based on one person and it's also based on a three separate removes from the actual story itself.
Yeah, well, I don't know the situation, you know, around the Post. That's not something I've written about, so I don't really want to opine about it since I don't know the details of it. I mean, I just come back to this story. I mean, I wrote about it because I think it's whatever Hersh reports is worth reporting. I also reported on what I felt was weak about the story. So, you know, I don't go in saying this story is God's truth because Seymour Hersh said it. And I don't go in saying it's not true because Seymour Hersh said it. I think it's worth reporting because Hersh said it, given his track record, which is quite excellent over the decades, not just over the years. But, you know, that doesn't mean that his reporting is superior to somebody else's on this subject. You have to take it on a case-by-case basis.
No, I agree with you for sure. And I'm glad I was very glad you reported on it. I guess my feeling is, you know, if you thought it was credible, and certainly I think it's at least worth talking about, and I don't know, it just seems like I don't know why other people, CNN, other people don't feel like it's worth talking about more, given that they're talking doubly about other stories that I think are similarly sourced.
I think if he'd had a corroborating source, he would have gotten a lot more pickup from other news organizations. I think that was why they didn't pick it up. I know how those people think, and that's what they'll say. Now, you can say, well, they don't have that standard for any other story. But if you're talking about Hirsch's story, that's something that people are looking for. So, you know, he didn't have that in this case. So, which is too bad, because the question about chemical weapons use in Syria is an important one. And how do we know what we know? You know, one thing that Hirsch points out and is that, we still don't doctors and other people have not yet been to the site of this alleged attack. So we don't even really have good information about the victims, about what kind of chemicals were used. So, you know, it's still very unclear. And I went with the story because I think, you know, it's important to clear that up. You know, are the Syrians using chemical weapons or not? That's an important question.
Mm-hmm. No, I think so for sure. I mean, I think the other important question there, too, is the relationship between, you know, the government and the intelligence apparatus. Not that presidents don't ignore them all the time historically on a regular basis, but it would seem to me another notable fact that people, the public, should certainly take into account about Donald Trump and the things he's saying. If this story is true, if he so willfully would say, like, I don't even really care the alternate story, I decided that I'm going to launch this missile regardless. I mean, that seems like an important sort of character question for people to know about.
Yeah, and you know, the evidence that Hirsch cited and about how, based on transcripts between Russian and U.S. officers, suggests that, you know, that the president wasn't well informed about the kind of language that was used in these military communications, and that might have been misinterpreted to indicate a chemical attack when, in fact, it might not indicate that at all. So, yeah, you know, this idea of people with no experience analyzing raw intelligence, you know, a lot can go wrong. Let's put it that way.
That's a very good point. I mean, it definitely, if the story is true, some of these people know way less than we might expect or want to see. Well, you know, I think it sort of switching gears totally here to another interesting, important story that Trump is now playing. So it's a little bit off the beaten path, but you wrote about it in Newsweek, and I thought it was just very interesting given the way this came up in the campaign. Is there some potential new documents, I believe, in the Kennedy assassination that Trump will have some provenance over? Either is it releasing them or just whether or not or how exactly they come out?
Yeah, so there's a big batch of government documents related to the assassination of JFK, which are scheduled to be made public in October. And Trump can prevent their release if he wants, or he can approve of their release if he wants. So we don't know what's in the records, but they're clearly, we know something about them. And this is what I wrote in Newsweek. And, you know, these are very interesting records, not just about the Kennedy assassination, but about the CIA, about Watergate, about the secret government in general. So given Trump's differences with the CIA, you might think he would be in favor of releasing all of them, you know, and he's a big conspiracy theorist, so maybe this will help his conspiracy theories. The CIA is likely to oppose the release of this material, and I think it's an open question whether Trump will go along with them or not. I think we don't know what's going to happen there. But it is an interesting test for Trump, and it is an interesting test for the administration's rhetoric about, you know, a deep state is out to get me, you know. If there is a deep state, it would be capable of keeping records related to the assassination of the president, you know, secret for more than 55 years. And that's what we're looking at. So if these documents stay secret, that's an indication that, you know, the secret agencies of our government are extremely powerful. Will Trump take them on and make them do something they don't want to do and release these records? You know, I'd like to think so. That sounds sort of Trump-like, the best of Trump. But, you know, he's very erratic. He's very embattled right now. He's very confused. He doesn't have a good mastery of the issues involved. So I don't think we know what's going to happen, frankly.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things that you, let's say that he does support them and does release them, some of the things you might be most interested to take a look at, or that may be the things that might make the most headlines, potentially, at least based on, you know, the potential topic?
Sure. There's a bunch of things in there that are interesting. And I urge people to look up my article in Newsweek for a lot of the details, because I give a lot of details there. But one that's worth mentioning is there are the CIA files of the Watergate burglars. The Watergate burglary was the big political scandal that brought down President Nixon. Some people say that resembles the scandals that Trump is involved in now. Certainly people make that comparison to Watergate. And questions have always lingered about the CIA's role in the Watergate burglary and in Nixon's downfall. So there's a bunch of material in there about the burglars, and that might shed, you know, new light on that kind of prehistory of American politics, where you had a scandal that brought down a president that involved spying, that involved a lot of the same elements, obstruction of justice, et cetera, that we have in the Trump scandal. So that's one thing that I look for. Another is there's a file of the man who ran the CIA's assassination program in the 1960s, a man named Bill Harvey, who was a legendary character, very rough customer, very dangerous man, but a very skilled covert operative, and a man who hated the Kennedys, by the way. And a lot of suspicion by JFK conspiracy theorists has centered on Bill Harvey. Well, there's a big Bill Harvey file in the material that's supposed to be released. So those are a couple of things that I think a lot of people are looking forward to seeing later this year.
And if this, let's say that it does come out, would this be sort of the last batch of records? I think this is all coming out as regards to the 1992 Act that are to come out, or is there still more after this?
Well, you know, these are the last known records, I would put it that way. And so the government has identified and released a lot of JFK records, and this is the last of those records. So I would never say it's the last. There's still other evidence out there that, you know, is known to exist but has never surfaced. So it's among the last to come forward, but it's probably not the last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it'll be certainly interesting to see, and I'm sure many new – if they do come out, there'll be at least a handful of new books that are going to come out after this. I mean, it really does seem like to some degree maybe history is more important here, because I think you're right. I mean, the issue of whether or not there is a quote-unquote deep state and how it works and if it – you know, how it may have worked in the past and so on and so forth, that it's difficult really now to sort of confirm or deny any of these things that are being thrown around, since it's all contemporaneously, but able to look back and sort of see what happened, that perhaps that could maybe put a floor to some degree under some of these other discussions by giving us a better sense of, you know, what the parameters are for what some of these agencies may or may not do.
Absolutely. And I think that's the connection between my two articles. You know, articles, you know, these documents from long ago, from scandals long ago, tell us is, over time, we understand much better what was going on then. So, for example, at the time of the Watergate scandal, the fact that the burglars came from the CIA was noted, but it wasn't really explored. It wasn't the object of investigation. And now we see that it was much greater than we were ever told. So, you know, that's a indication of how the CIA operated in the middle of a political scandal. Well, that's not irrelevant today, right? Because same situation. We've got an embattled president at odds with the CIA. You know, so what the CIA did in the past can be a guide, not infallible, but can be a guide to what they're doing today.
Well, and you have a new book coming out on the CIA, so I want to talk a little bit about that. What should people expect from your new publication?
So I'm going to publish in October a book called The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton. And it is a biography of Angleton, who was a very powerful official at the CIA from its founding in 1947 through 1975. And Angleton was a kind of founding father of the CIA. And a lot of the policies that we see today, for example, like mass surveillance, can be traced back to Angleton. So this is a book about the deep roots of secret agencies in American life. And it's very revelatory about incidents that we never knew before that Angleton and the CIA were very involved in, such as Watergate, such as the JFK assassination, such as U.S. relations with Israel. So this book really sheds a whole new light on the CIA in its founding years and tells some very interesting and sensational stories. So it's relevant to today because this is where the national security system that we now live under, this is when it came into being, and this is one of the men who helped create it. So it's called The Ghost, James Jesus Angleton, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton.
Well, I'm definitely going to put a pre-order on that one. I love all these old histories of the FBI CIA stuff, I have to say.
And thanks for that mention. It can be pre-ordered on Barnes & Noble and Amazon now, so you can get your copy soon.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things I really actually appreciate about all this historiography that's been coming out in the last few years about these early days of the CIA, the whole National Security Council, and an establishment that is interesting to me and I think doesn't get played enough is how, in the history of the country, how a lot of these institutions are just very recent creations. And a lot of times we talk about them in the modern discourse of the FBI, the CIA, as if in like 1789, you know, they were sitting right there on Pennsylvania Avenue or out in Langley doing the same thing. And that historical perspective in terms of both what we think of in terms of permanence and how we structure things seems very important to me.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. These agents and the deference that they get under law and the secrecy that surrounds them is all new. It all starts after World War II, and it's nothing like the founding fathers anticipated. We really have two governments. We have the Madisonian government, Congress, Supreme Court, President, executive branch agencies, but then we have this national security government, secretive intelligence agencies, which we don't really know what their budgets are, or we don't know what they're spending their money on. Their operations are secret by law. And this other parallel government operates, in conjunction with the elected government, but it's not really controlled by the elected government. You know, we can't get, it doesn't make any difference which president, who's president, these national security agencies, their mission is not affected by the change in the presidency. So it's really an unprecedented situation and very different from the one that the people who created this country anticipated. So all of these stories, you know, revolve around the same fact. You know, what is the secret government doing and how do we hold it accountable? That's really what I try to write about.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think that's an extraordinarily important question, big in the contemporaneous sphere here. So we'll definitely be looking for that and be excited once the book drops to have you back on and talk about some of the implications. That's Jeff Morley. You can check him out in many places. Alternate, he had a great article in Newsweek about the JFK documents that we mentioned on this show. So please check out all of his work everywhere you can find it. We're going to take another break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Per Year. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Per Year, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing our ongoing conversation about this roller coaster ride of a healthcare, or some may say health denial bill coming from Republicans in the Senate. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Dr. Carol Paris, who's the president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Paris, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
So we are still in the thick of this thing. Obviously, the vote was not going to happen this week, but I know that's Ted Cruz trying to push a compromise of all people. So still, the issue is still live here. It's not dead yet. I mean, one thing that seems just so remarkable to me is that I don't know if this is going to be the case, but it does seem that if this fails, that there's really only one other way that we can go, and that's to either leave the ACA the way it is, which will keep causing problems, but really in terms of change, single-payer healthcare. So in a weird way, is this maybe one of the most propitious moments to be talking about single-payer?
It absolutely is. And what I have seen just since January with the introduction of this whole debate about going backwards from the ACA is a uptick in activism, not only at PNHP. We've gained 500 members just this year. But I was just on a conference call this morning with 11 different physician organizations. We're talking about probably 500,000 or so total number of members. And every one of them talked about how physicians are just outraged by this and have become outspoken advocates, mostly against going backwards from the ACA, but not stopping there, going forward and saying, no, what we need going forward is Medicare for all.
You know, one very interesting sort of piece of polling that I know you're very familiar with was the YouGov poll from April of this year. 46% of Republicans, 40% of Trump voters favoring an expansion of Medicare for – or favoring basically a Medicare for all. And sort of my question flowing from that, because those are pretty high numbers, that means there must be some Republicans in Congress who would endorse something like an H.R. 676. But how do we make that case to those people who may not be opposed but, you know, are a little afraid to come out on an issue like this because it seems like, you know, it's only a quote-unquote left-wing thing?
Well, I think we do it the same way that the civil rights movement. I mean, that they taught us everything we need to know about how to make a social change happen. It's not going to happen because we convince our leaders to see things our way. It happens because we create a movement of movements, and we make a situation where it's toxic for our legislators not to get on board. Lyndon Johnson didn't suddenly have a change of heart. The civil rights movement made it toxic for him not to act.
You know, I'm curious in terms of how this thing is playing out in Congress. If you think, I mean, I saw that Chuck Schumer has come out and he's argued for, you know, the White House and Republicans to work closer with Democratic senators. I saw the Center for American Progress put out some little piece, sort of their proposal to change and fix the ACA. I mean, do you suspect that there's any real middle ground here in this conversation like that? Or is that really more just sort of political talking points kind of stuff from the Senate Democrats?
I think that the Senate Democrats are going to try to appear to be contributing, and I don't know what their intention is, but I'm almost guessing that they're as afraid if this bill, whatever happens with this bill, I think they're afraid that the next step is just what you said at the opening, that we're going to move to a Medicare for all. And I don't think that our Democratic legislators are members of Congress are really and truly any more prepared for that. Yes, we've got 113 co-sponsors of H.R. 676, but it's easy to co-sponsor a bill when you don't think it's going to go anywhere. I mean, let's not forget that we had majority in both houses of Congress and a Democratic president in 2009. And what did we pass?
Right, the ACA.
We passed the ACA, which was a Republican plan with no Republican support. So, you know, I'm not a political pundit, but I think what we need is what George Lakey calls a movement of movements. When the American people, both conservative and liberal, come together and realize that it's in all of our best interest for us to all have health care, that's when it's going to happen. And then it doesn't matter whether we have Republicans or Democrats in the House because or in the Senate, because they all have the same agenda. All they want is to get reelected. Whether you're a Democrat or a Senate or a Republican, really, you're all about getting reelected. And if we organize in your district, and we make it toxic for you not to support what we want, you're going to come around.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think it's certainly in terms of Senate Democrats, it's a well taken point given what we saw take place in California with the single payer, which I guess now has been more or less shelved by the Rendon there because, you know, he doesn't really want to get into it. I mean, I thought that was just so, I mean, it's just this, well, one, I'm curious, part one of the question, what you even think about these state led efforts. I think there's some people who think that's a little bit of a panacea. But two, I mean, this boogeyman of the cost has again become the issue in California, which is, you know, the fifth largest world economy. So it seems like a little bit of a straw man. But I'm curious what you think about both those issues. I mean, one, whether we should be pushing on the state level, and two, whether the sort of quote unquote financial viability issue was really an issue.
Well, as far as whether we should be trying to enact single payer at the state level, I think that it's not my place to discourage a state that wants to try that from doing it. Do I think that it's likely to happen? Well, I mean, let's face it, even in California, where it's probably got the best chance of happening, they still have to get waivers from the Department of Health and Human Services. And do you really think Tom Price at HHS is going to give California a waiver so that they can take their Medicare funds and use them to eliminate the for-profit insurance industry? I don't think so. I think he'd be very happy to give them a Medicare and a Medicaid waiver if what they were using those waivers for was to completely privatize Medicare and Medicaid. Oh, you'd get a waiver in a heartbeat, but you're not going to get a waiver to essentially eliminate the for-profit insurance industry. So I think the states have a real challenge, but I encourage states to pursue this because it's a great organizing tool. I mean, any state that gets the majority of its populace on board with a state single payer bill, well, those are people who also support a national bill. So I don't have any objection to trying it. I just think that they really, I think they're pushing an even bigger boulder up an even steeper hill in many ways than we are going for it at a national level. Now, the other issue I get so tired of arguing the cost, the financing of a single payer bill. Yes, our taxes may go up, but why is it that people want their taxes to be lower? Is it just because they philosophically want their taxes to be lower? No, it's because they think if their taxes are lower, they're going to have more money in their pocket, right? Their take-home pay is going to be higher. Well, guess what happens if we have a single-payer system in this country? Yes, your taxes go up a little bit. Those are pre-tax dollars. I mean, the taxes go up, so that's a reality. But what goes away are all of your post-tax, the cost of premiums, co-pays, deductibles, in-network, out-of-network, all of the dental, vision, long-term care, all of the things that are paid for with after-tax dollars. So what we know is that for 95% of Americans, at the end of the day, with a national health single, with a Medicare for all, your taxes will go up a little bit and your take-home pay will go up too.
Well, it'd be easy for me to get on board with that.
I mean, I'm all for having more money in my pocket at the end of the day. And in exchange for that, I also accept paying a little bit more in taxes, which it's a wash because I've got more money in my pocket. And not to mention, I now have comprehensive health care and I have free choice of doctor, of hospital. I have no longer am I being told by some insurance company bureaucrat what hospital I can go to, what doctor I can see, what test that doctor can order. All of that goes away. We get the insurance industry out from between the doctor-patient relationship. And as a doctor, I can tell you that has a lot of appeal for doctors. And I think that's why we're seeing so many doctors who in the past were either passively against, opposed to single payer, or neutral. I think now we're seeing more and more of them moving into being supportive because they're being absolutely exhausted and burned out by the amount of paperwork and bureaucracy that they deal with. 2 hours a day of paperwork for every hour of patient contact is the average now for physicians.
Wow. I mean, you know, the other issue related to that, I'm glad you raised it in terms of the tax issues, is, I mean, I also always find a logical fallacy being as if we aren't paying a lot right now. I mean, even if it's in sort of different ways, I mean, out of your own pocket and the premiums, the sort of cost we have to pay and a society of having sort of a less healthy populace over time. I mean, we're sort of paying either way. And it almost seems, especially since that was the whole Obamacare thing, right, was the we got to sort of change the cost curve because healthcare is just becoming more and more expensive. Either way, we have to bend the cost curve the other direction, that it really isn't a question of whether it's expensive or not. I mean, it really is a question of if healthcare is going to cost something some way, somehow. So it almost seems it's like the reverse. Like single payer is the most sort of predictable way to say like, okay, this is what it's going to cost to do healthcare. Where any other way, I mean, who knows? The cost is going to go up. Obviously, society is going to have its own issues that are going to come from this. I mean, the cost is going to be high. To me, it seems almost higher to not do single payer.
I agree with you. And you make a good point that whole focus of the insurance industry, health insurance industry, is to make a profit. If we actually eliminated the profit and the bureaucracy from the system just by getting rid of the for-profit insurance industry, we already know that would amount to about $500 billion. Then if we can add another $100 billion, $106 billion by negotiating drug prices. That's just for starters. Now, do we have obscenely expensive health care in this country? Yes, we do. And a lot of that is because there's also a lot of fraud and abuse and waste on the delivery side of health care. But we're not going to be able to capture that and redirect it until we have everybody in the same risk pool. Once we're all in the same risk pool, suddenly it's to all our benefit to get rid of the waste, fraud, and abuse that is in the delivery side. But right now, we don't even know where it is or how to capture it because our healthcare system is so fragmented that it's like whack-a-mole. You can't even put your finger on it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I mean, it's so surreal. I saw something the other day. I think it's like in New Jersey is something about Blue Cross, but the thing that it was talking about was how it was a nonprofit corporation, which I don't know, I guess technically it was, but it just sort of blew my mind that like the billions of dollars that are being generated here and like there's this fiction that this entity is a nonprofit. I mean, it just everything about American healthcare just seems so through the looking glass. And at the end of the day, it seems like the biggest proof in the pudding on all of this is that of all industrialized nations, we are doing by far the worst on healthcare costs and healthcare outcomes. I mean, it seems like there's no better real test than that, right?
Right. We're spending more and our outcomes are nothing to write home about. And I think we also have to talk about the cost in human suffering and actually in human lives. The Annals of Internal Medicine just this week published a paper by David Himmelstein and Steffi Woolhandler, who updated the Institute of Medicine's report. And now the statistic is that for every 769 people who lack health insurance, one will die each year. So that means that if the CBO is correct, and 22 million Americans lose their coverage with the Senate bill, that translates to 29,000 additional preventable deaths every year. And let's not forget that there's 28 million Americans who never got health insurance with the Affordable Care Act. So I did the math yesterday, and what it adds up to is actually 65,000 preventable deaths a year total. That's more than we had at the height of the AIDS epidemic. Can you think of any other situation in this country where 65,000 people were dying every year and it didn't get more than a footnote of media coverage?
I mean, it's shocking. I wasn't even 100% sure what to say. I mean, I don't think I've seen one major media outlet reproduce that number. And it just seems like that's one of those things that someone would have thought, like, hey, everyone's talking about healthcare. You know, people could die. Let's try to calculate that. And not at all. Wow. That's extraordinary, extraordinary statistic on so many different levels, I have to say, in terms of the human cost. So, you know, fair enough. I think you're making excellent points there. I'll just say we have a minute left. Anything you really want people who are looking at this and care about single payer healthcare to really take away as a final note?
Yes. The July recess is happening and the bill has not been decided. So get busy. Go to town halls. Go to your senator and congressman. Complain. Argue, write letters to the editor, send them letters, be as vocal and in their face as you can be. By any means necessary, short of violence, I'm nonviolent, but now is the time for direct action. Do a sit-in, whatever it takes. We have to up the energy and make these legislators know that we're mad as hell and we're not taking it anymore. You've got to listen to us.
Well, excellent end point there, I think. Dr. Carol Paris for Physicians for National Health Insurance, thank you so much for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. That's where we're going to leave our show here today. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.